What is objectivism? Today on The Curious Task, I'm speaking with Craig Biddle. Welcome to The Curious Task, a podcast where we explore economics, philosophy, and politics from a classical liberal perspective. I'm your host, Matt Buffton, and today I'm speaking with Craig Biddle. Craig is the editor-in-chief of The Objective Standard, executive director of The Objective Standard Institute, and also the executive director of the Prometheus Foundation. He's the author of several books and hundreds of articles about Ayn Rand's philosophy of objectivism, and he's also the host of the upcoming podcast, Understanding. So, Craig, here on the podcast, we'd like to start with a question and go wherever the answers take us. So I'm going to pitch it right to you. What is objectivism?
All right. That's a good place to start. And thanks for having me on. I'm delighted to be here. Objectivism is the name that Ayn Rand gave to her philosophy. Ayn Rand is the Russian-American, born in Russia, moved to American, and self-described American philosopher and novelist who wrote famous books, The Fountainhead, Atlas Shrugged, Capitalism, The Unknown Ideal, The Virtue of Selfishness, and several others. So she's really known for her novels and her nonfiction, but she gave a name to the body of ideas, the body of philosophic ideas presented in her works, and that name is objectivism. And the philosophy really consists of a focus at each of the branches of philosophy. So in metaphysics, the most fundamental branch, which is about what is the nature of the universe in which we live, what, if any, are the natural laws that hold and that we must recognize and abide by if we're going to function properly. And there she held that things are what they are. The law of identity, a thing is what it is, and the law of causality, a thing can act only in accordance with its nature. So a rose can bloom or wilt, but it can't speak, right? And so things have a nature, and they have to act in accordance with their nature. In epistemology, the next branch of philosophy, which is concerned with how do we know, how do we gain knowledge, and how do we know when we know, how can we validate or verify knowledge. And there she held that reason, observation, and conceptual integration and the use of logic is man's only means of knowledge. If we want to know what's true, we have to look out at reality, we have to use our five senses and integrate what we observe into concepts that remain anchored in reality, and then use those concepts to come up with, you know, theories and principles and whatnot. And that's how we build knowledge off of the base of sensory perception. And this is very Aristotelian, and John Locke agreed primarily with this idea too. So it's not completely out of the blue, but she held to these ideas really, really strictly. So she denied, for instance, that faith is a means of knowledge. And she recognized that that is a real problem if you claim that faith is a means of knowledge or any kind of mysticism. So she was pro-reason and anti-mysticism in epistemology. In ethics, which is perhaps her most controversial area, she held that all forms of human sacrifice, whether self-sacrifice or sacrifice of others, is wrong. It's just wrong because it's contrary to the requirements of human life. As human beings, we don't need to give up our values. We don't need to say, oh, here's something that's really important to me, so I'm going to give it away or throw it away or not take it seriously. She said exactly the opposite is true. As human beings, we need to identify the values on which our life and happiness depend, pursue and uphold those values, and respect the rights of others to do the same. And so in ethics, although her ideas are controversial, it really comes down to the most beautiful thing I can think of, which is that, hey, let's all pursue our values, not give up greater values for the sake of lesser values, not commit sacrifices. You produce what you want to produce. I'll produce what I want to produce. We'll decide when we will and when we won't engage together voluntarily. And then we can all thrive in harmony together, right? So as controversial as her ethics is, because it's counter to the Judeo-Christian sort of idea that, you know, altruism or giving up your values for others, sacrificing for others is good. She denies that, but if you really pay attention to what she's saying and take it seriously, what she's talking about is a way for all of us to live beautiful lives in harmony. So although her ethics is controversial, I think it's really important that people take some time with it and understand what she's saying. And then in politics, which flow, her politics really just flows kind of right out of her ethics. If it's true that all of us should pursue our own values and respect each other's rights to do that so that we can live in harmony and trade when we want and not when we don't, then we need a political system that protects that ability, that protects our right to act on our judgment and choose our goals. So she upheld laissez-faire capitalism, pure, unregulated, unadulterated capitalism, whereby there is a government. This is not anarchism. There's a government, but the government does one thing and only one thing, and it does it really well. And that one thing is it protects everyone's rights by banning coercion, the initiation of physical force, from human relationships. So no one's allowed to steal each other's stuff or defame anyone or extort anyone, so any kind of force, whether it's direct or indirect, that's outlawed. And the government does one thing, and that is it outlaws that and protects our rights by using force only in retaliation and only against those who initiate its use. So if I come to steal stuff from you, the government legitimately, through the police, can stop me or hunt me down if I've stolen it and try me in a court of law. And if they find me guilty, they can punish me because I've violated your rights. But aside from that kind of thing, the government just keeps its hands off. That's what laissez-faire means, hands off. And this enables everyone to live his or her life the way that he or she wants to live her life and not be told, well, you have to do this or you can't do that. The only thing you can't do is use force against people, which is contrary to life. So that's her metaphysics, her epistemology, her ethics, and her politics. And of course, because she herself was an artist, a novelist, she's got a whole theory of aesthetics as well, which is fascinating. But given that our primary focus here is on the relationship of her ideas to classical liberalism, I won't get into all of that, but. Her book, The Romantic Manifesto, sort of outlines her thoughts on aesthetics, and it's a fascinating journey.
That's a great introduction. Thank you. I think that much of our conversation over the next hour or so will be pulling at various threads in what you've just said and asking you to expand on that. I'd like to start with rights. When I asked you to come on the podcast, I asked, was there any reading that I should do to prepare? And he sent me four essays, two by yourself and two by Rand. And there's a lot of discussion of rights in those essays. And I think that is probably a pretty foundational bit that we can start with. So according to Rand, what are rights and where do they come from?
Great question. So this is one of the several areas where Rand really did some heavy lifting in philosophy. The traditional approach to rights, even through the era of classical liberalism, with John Locke and Adam Smith and J.B. Say and so forth, and the founders of America, people were under the impression that either rights come from God somehow. This is John Locke's idea that there's a natural moral law and rights emanate from that. But where does the natural moral law come from? Well, it comes from God. So ultimately, even though it sounds like when people talk about natural rights historically, it sounds like they're talking about rights coming from nature. They're really in that context talking about rights coming from supernature, right? So if as the founders say in the Declaration of Independence, our rights come from our creator, right? The idea there being that they come from God, then they don't come from nature. They come from supernature. And so the idea either they come from God or they come from man, right? They're created by governments. So the government says you can do X, Y, Z, so you can do that. And they say you can't do this, so you can't do that. And those are your rights. Rand denied this false alternative. She thought that both of these claims basically amounted to subjectivism. Rights come from some consciousness. Government says you can do this, so you can do it. All right. Well, then, if you live in Nazi Germany or in Gaza today, then your rights are whatever the governments there say you can do and what you can't do. That's an evisceration of rights, right? That doesn't mean that's not rights. That's permissions from a government, right? The whole point of the concept of rights is it's supposed to say, hey, there's a moral prerogative that individuals have that precedes government. That's supposed to undergird government and tell governments and laws what they may and may not do or prescribe or proscribe, right? So that's the problem with rights coming from either government and also coming from God. Because if rights come from God, then whatever God says, and by the way, who's going to tell us what God says other than his representatives here on earth? And who are they going to be, right? The Pope or some, dictator who claims to have a direct line to God. So there's no evidence for God, so we're stuck there. But even if there was a God, and even if rights did come from him telling us what to do, they still wouldn't be rights. They'd be supernatural permissions, which means that if God tells you, hey, Abram, kill your son Isaac for me to demonstrate that you are truly obedient to me, right, as happens in the Old Testament, Abram's duty then is to kill his son Isaac because God said so. And the fact that God interrupts that in the Old Testament doesn't change the fact that it's a demonstration of what it would mean if we're just supposed to do whatever God tells us to do, right? Rand saw this as a problem. You can't just, if we want to have rights, if we want to identify a moral prerogative to act on our judgment and live our lives the way that we want to live our lives, we need to be able to anchor that idea somehow in real nature. Not in human beings' opinions, not in collective consciousness, not in the opinions of society or the votes of the populace, but rather in facts. So what she does is she steps away from the whole thing and says, look, what are rights in effect and why do we need these things? If we need rights, then the reason why we need them is going to shed a lot of light on what facts of reality give rise to them, right? If you need something, there must be some fact, some reason why you need it. What is that reason? And this is the way she approached a lot of things. She always wanted to know, what's the hierarchical structure? What underlies this idea and ties it to reality? So she's looking at human beings. And by the way, this is integrated with her whole theory of ethics, which is about, why we should act in rationally self-interested manner. And so she's leveraging that. She says, in order for human beings to live, they have to use their basic means of living. What is that? It's their reasoning mind. And this is an Aristotelian idea, right? What differentiates man from other animals and what makes us special is the fact that we are able to reason, to use logic, to draw from the evidence of our senses and form concepts and propositions and principles and rise to this level, this kind of weird level that we are above all of the other animals and think and plan and project long range and take everything that matters seriously if we choose to and really try to figure out how to live. Well, Rand says in order to do that, we need to be free of the one thing that other people can do that can stop us from doing that, right? And that one thing, she observes, is force. If I strap you to a tree, right? I think it would go the other way. You're bigger than me. If you strap me to a tree, right? I can't act on my judgment. If you put me in a cage, I can't act on my judgment. If you shoot me in the head or tell me, if you don't do what I say, I will kill you or put you in a cage. I can't act on my judgment, right? This is why slavery is wrong, because it stops human beings from acting on their judgment in pursuit of their own purposes and values. That's why it's wrong. That's why when Frederick Douglass escaped slavery and got to freedom and then wrote his ex-owner, Thomas Auld, and said, hey, I just want to send you a note to inform you that I, like you, am an individual. I, like you, own my own life. I, like you, have a mind and should be free to act on that mind, right? That's what this is all about. And it's just a fact that a human life is a life guided by the judgment of one's own mind. And this is Rand's point. So basically, her idea of a right is not a supernatural permission and not a permission from Congress, but rather a recognition of a certain fact. What is that fact? It's the fact that in order for a human being to live as a human being, he must be free to act on the thing that makes him human, the judgment of his mind. Now, I'm delivering it in a very simplified way here, but the power of this theory of rights is so strong. Because you probably know that, for instance, Jeremy Bentham and other utilitarians would say of rights that they're nonsense upon stilts. And Alasdair MacIntyre says rights are one with witches and unicorns. Why? Because there's equal evidence for the existence of these things, right? And so people have been wrestling for eons with this idea. Well, if rights are real, what are the facts that give rise to these things? Rand identifies these facts, and it's a game changer for we advocates of liberty, because it means we can stop saying, oh, they come from God, we know not how, or they come from nature, we know not how, or they come from Congress, which means there are no rights. And we can instead say, well, rights are simply recognitions of the factual requirements of human life in a social context. So her theory, I'll pause here because I don't want to keep going and going, but her theory of rights is so powerful. So I urge people in your audience to look into it. And, you know, go at all of Rand's ideas critically, right? I tell people when I was reading Rand's works initially, I kind of read it with a book in one hand and a dagger in the other. I was like, I'm going to look for every hole in your arguments, et cetera, et cetera. Do that. Read her ideas that way, but read them because they really are mind-blowingly powerful.
That's great. Thanks. Now, I'm not a philosopher, but I do have some friends who are philosophers. I hang out with some philosophers. And I tend to think of sort of philosophical arguments about rights as coming from a couple different sources, putting them in a couple different buckets, one of which being the natural rights sort of bucket, and the other being the consequentialist or utilitarian arguments that you mentioned. I always think of or have thought of Ayn Rand as a natural rights philosopher, but hearing you speak there starts to make me wonder if it's not the case that these rights exist elsewhere. Is it the case that it's more of a consequentialist philosophy? Because this is a fact, and if we all recognize the truth of this fact, then we will be happier, and that was why it's a better way to approach, to adopt objectivism, to adopt Rand's view of rights. Am I off base there?
No, it's a really good question, and a good friend of mine, Timothy Sandifer, and I, and a few other people I know who agree with me largely on philosophic matters, have disputed, have sort of debated whether Ayn Rand's theory of rights fits into the traditional natural theory of rights category, or whether it's something separate. And I could make arguments either way, frankly, but here's the reason I come down on just saying that Rand's theory is a new category. And I call it objective rights versus natural rights. The problem with the concept of natural rights historically is that almost all, and in fact, you could really argue all people who called themselves natural rights theorists or are categorized as natural rights theorists. So Hugo Grotius, Samuel Pufendorf, John Locke, the American founders, and so on and so forth. They all held that rights ultimately come from God. Right. John Locke, as I said earlier, held that that rights come from a natural moral law. So there's political rights come from a natural moral law. So he is going deeper and it sounds good. They come from natural law. But where does he say the natural law comes from? It comes from God, which means we're not really anchoring this in natural law. We're anchoring it in supernatural law, which is, in my view, not even a thing. It's just a made up concept. And because you can't prove that, in order to prove that rights come from God, you first have to prove God exists, A, and then B, you're going to have to prove that rights somehow emanate from his will inhere in us, and he can't then change it, even though he's all powerful, right? I mean, it's just a train wreck if you try to go that way, which is why it always has been. You can't anchor rights that way. So because of that, Instead of categorizing Rand's theory under natural rights, because then it would be in there with all of these ideas of supernatural rights, I like to point out if that hadn't been the history of that term, it would have been a fine term for Ayn Rand's theory, because her theory really does come from natural moral law, but her natural moral law is anchored not in supernature, but in the factual requirements of human life, right? We could talk more about that. So I don't think it's a big deal whether you decide to categorize her as a special category under natural law that actually ties to nature versus supernature, or whether you say, look, it's a different theory, it's objective. And the last thing I'll say on this is she made a very important distinction that's helpful to understand not only this point in her philosophy, but many points in her philosophy. She held that there's a difference, there's a trichotomy of ways to look at either the true or the good or rights, anything we're going to advocate or anything we're going to prescribe, so anything prescriptive. And she held that there's the subjective, which means that it's just made up in the human mind. It's just arbitrarily made up. I can say witches and unicorns exist, and I can say rights exist. It's, if I say it, it goes, or if God says it, it goes. Whatever. And then she said there's what people mistake for objective, and she termed this the intrinsic. And this is a big lever in her thinking. Whereas the subjective is just in here, the idea of the intrinsic truth or the intrinsic good or intrinsic rights means that they are out there somewhere. The truth is out there, or the good is out there, or rights are out there. And what we have to do is either have them hit us, you know, through a revelation, or go out and find them. Where are the rights? Can I look under this rock and find rights here? Can I find morality out there? Right. This is why, for instance, David Hume says you can't get to an ought from an is, right? Because start looking around. Where's the ought? I don't see an ought. The same kind of thing is going on with rights. I look around. I don't see rights. I don't see any evidence for rights. Therefore, rights are nonsense upon stilts, or whatever the cliche is going to be. And Rand says that the idea that rights are out there, or that the good is out there, is just mistaken. Rights are neither in here nor out there. So what are they? They are a combination of the mind and fact. They are a recognition, that's the in here part, of some fact which is real out there. What is the fact out there? Human beings have a nature. In order to live, we have to act on the thing that makes us human, the things that enables us to live, reason. That's how we figure out what things are, how we can put them together to build the values that support and sustain our lives, et cetera, et cetera. So that's a fact, and it's an indisputable fact. We can see that it's true throughout all of history. If we recognize that fact, and then we also recognize that when a government or a group or a thug comes along and stops us from acting on our judgment, we can't then live as human beings. So you see the difference now between the subjective, it's just made up, the objective, it's out there somewhere, but nobody's been able to find it. So, you know, we just have to say, well, it must come from supernature or something like that. And Rand's view, which is, hey, that's a false alternative, that it's either made up in here or it exists out there somewhere on its own. Objectivity, in her view, is precisely the relationship, the positive correspondence between a mind and the facts of reality. And this theory of hers, this theory of objectivity versus intrinsicism and subjectivism, is the essence. It's really the core of the way she approaches everything. And it's so powerful once you get your head around it, because you see it all over the place, the ways that it applies.
That's great. One more question on rights, and then we'll move on to some of the other areas. Ayn Rand talks about property rights as being particularly important. What's the significance of property rights in objectivism?
Yeah, this is great. And she really does put a lot of emphasis on this. So Rand, like the founding fathers, holds that we have rights that are, the founders thought all that they come from our creator. They also thought that they were self-evident. So in different sentences, they use different terminology. And Rand agreed that we do have these rights, particularly the rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Now, those three are actually mentioned in the Declaration of Independence, and the right to property is not. But the right to property is really an aspect of these other rights. It's an aspect of the right to liberty, because the right to liberty is the right to act on your judgment without being coerced, you know, to act against it. And when you produce a value, you have a right to produce and use and keep that value. And all of those are verbs, right? The right to use and keep or dispose of, all of those are verbs, the values that you produce. And that's what the right to property is. So it's really a species of or an aspect of the right to liberty. Well, if you have a right to life, which is the right to act as you need in order to live, and you have a right to liberty, which is the right to act on your judgment without being coerced to act against it, which is sort of a restatement of the right to life. And you have a right to the pursuit of happiness, which is the right to choose and pursue the values and goals that you think will make your life great, so that you can't tell me what to pursue and I can't tell you what to pursue. How are you going to do any of this if you can't keep and use the stuff that you produce, right? So just try to imagine it, right? Okay, I'm going to live and I'm going to pursue my happiness. And every time I produce something, the government comes along and says, oops, that's mine. Or some king or thug comes along and says, you know, I'm taking that. It belongs to me. Or they just take it. They don't even have to say it belongs to me. If you produce food but can't eat it, you can't live. If you produce, you know, if you build a house, but somebody takes it from you, you don't have shelter, and so on and so forth. So the right to keep, use, and dispose of the product of your effort, whether it's food, a house, a symphony, or a book, right? So intellectual property rights come into this too. If you can't keep and use the things you produce, you can't use them to support your life. So there's a sense in which the right to property undergirds and enables all of the other rights, because you just can't really find. But this is true of, you can think of all of the legitimate rights this way. Now, you know, they're the illegitimate rights, the claims to, I have a right to education, or I have a right to healthcare, or whatever. And all of that is predicated on the idea that somebody else has to supply you with these goods, education, healthcare, or whatever, right? So traditionally, these are called positive rights, right? Somebody has to give these to you, versus negative rights. I have a right to freedom from force. Rand thought that that's not a good way to think about it, really, because it is a positive idea. It's a positive both in that you can posit it, and in that it is also something good and positive to say you have a moral prerogative to live your life according to your judgment and to keep and use the product of your effort, right? That's the positive thing. And then the negative is, and therefore no one has a moral prerogative to take it from you. And if they do, you can't live fully. So that's the sort of the integration between the broader theory of rights and the right to property. But really, it's all integrated in one fundamental idea. And that is, in order to live, you got to be free to act on your judgment. And that includes the freedom to keep, use, and dispose of the product of your effort.
That's actually a great segue into what I want to talk about next, which is altruism. So you've talked about rights, and of course, there will be some people in society, maybe a lot of people, who find this description of rights wanting, they don't agree with it. But there will be another segment of people who do find this quite compelling. I mean, Rand's novels continue to sell very well. People are very interested in this. And there are many people who are not perhaps full-blown objectivists who will find things they like in this theory of rights. However, when it comes to Rand's thoughts and comments on altruism, we sort of open up another area where we might say that perhaps, you know, I'm at the office, I'm earning some money with my labor, I stop on the way home, I buy a box of donuts, I come into my home where I live with my wife and kids. And there's an idea that, of course, you know, I have bought those donuts with my money and my time, I have a right to them. However, I'm probably not going to say to the wife and kids, you cannot have any donuts, those are all mine. And many people might say, well, you would have a right to do that, but you should not do that. And only a greedy person like Ayn Rand, who hates altruism, would ever think you should possibly, you know, force your wife and kids to buy the donuts from you if they want some. So what would Ayn Rand think about me sharing my food with my wife and kids? And what are her thoughts on altruism?
Great question. Pardon my clearing my throat today. The allergies here in Southern California are killing me. This is a great question. I'll put everything in positive terms first here, because I think it's the easiest way to really get your head around it. So in order to live a beautiful life, right, if that's what we're after a flourishing life, I want to wake up and love my day and love the people I hang out with and choose to include in my life, my wife, my family, my friends, my coworkers. I want to keep the people who I don't think highly of or who bore me to death. I don't want to attack them. That's not my thing, but I don't want them in my life. So I'm going to design my life around my values. I'm going to choose the work I love to do, and I'm going to pursue that. I'm going to choose the people I want to hang out with, and I'm going to pursue those relationships and try to make them great. That's really what a beautiful life looks like, right? And we do this long term, and we try to build all the things that we love into our lives, our recreational activities, the music and art that we love, et cetera, et cetera. And we all know on some level, this is really what a beautiful human life looks like, right? It's using your mind to figure out what is going to make your life great and then pursuing that stuff and really going after it. Well, is it the case that to foster good relationships, the best way to do that is to not, you know, share any values with the people you love, or not engage with people in a way that is mutually beneficial, you know, to engage in trade, right? And when you put it this way, it's obvious that it's not the case that the way to have a beautiful relationship with someone is to not trade with them. Trade doesn't happen only at the material level. It's not only, hey, you have a donut and I have a dollar, let's make a trade, and then we both have this new material thing. Trade is also a spiritual exchange. It also includes spiritual exchange, right? My wife and I absolutely love each other. And that love does not consist in her giving me donuts and me giving her dollars. It consists in us sharing our lives together and reaping the benefits from each other, exchanging, you know, the laughter that we enjoy, her thoughts on a comedian that we just listened to, a new piece of music I just found that I want to share with her, right? It's all of this back and forth with our friends, our lovers, the people that matter to us. That's what good human relationships, life-serving human relationships consist of, is that kind of back and forth. And on some level, everyone knows this. The problem is we also have been raised with this idea that self-interest is bad and self-sacrifice is good. And this idea sneaks in and comes underneath these otherwise relatively obvious points. Like, of course, you don't want to not share a donut with your kids or your wife, right? And it comes under that and makes us feel skeptical about the idea of either sometimes just having something for ourselves. And it also makes us feel like, well, when we share with other people, we're actually sacrificing, and that's good. So we'll share stuff with other people in that. But sharing with other people when you're getting something out of it is not a sacrifice, it's a gain. It's an advancement of your values. So Rand took sacrifice really seriously. And what she said basically is this: sacrifice does not mean being nice to people or being benevolent or trading value for value with them, whether material or spiritual. Sacrificing means giving up a greater value for the sake of a lesser value. And it's usually driven by the idea that that act, giving up a greater value for the sake of a lesser value, is moral. That's the right way to act. Well, if this were true, then to be moral, we should all just keep giving up values to other people. Now, what are they supposed to do when we try to give them a value? Because accepting the value would be self-interested, so they really shouldn't do that. So we just all give up our values, and then what happens? We all die. We don't need to give up our values in order to live. We need to do precisely the opposite. We need to identify, pursue, keep, trade, and work with our values, and then respect the rights of each other to do the same. So if this is why she draws the distinction between egoism and altruism. So altruism is the moral code that says to be moral, you must give up values to other people. Altruism means otherism. Alter is other. So it literally means otherism, treating others as more important than yourself. So you always give up values for them. Egoism is in effect the opposite, but only in the good ways. So it means I-ism or me-ism, right? My life and my thoughts and my actions are primarily about me. But what is my life? Is my life just me on a desert island and not caring about anyone else? No. My life is me, the people I love and care about, they're a huge aspect of my life, they're my values, the work I do, the recreational stuff I do, the art I love, it's the whole constellation of values that fills out the me that I want to have a beautiful life for. And what she's saying is that what you should do and what everyone should do is pursue values and not sacrifice them, and also recognize everyone else's right to pursue values and not sacrifice them. So she disputes sacrifice wholly. She says it's immoral to sacrifice yourself for others. It's immoral to sacrifice others for yourself. What morality consists of is non-sacrifice. Morality consists of value pursuit, recognition and respect for individual rights, and living a beautiful life in harmony with the people who you want to engage with. So put that way, now you can take any example where somebody says, well, you know, what about sacrifice? What about giving this thing for other people? If you're getting something out of it that's important to your life, then it's not a sacrifice. It's a gain. If you're not, if you're literally giving up something that's more important to your life for something that's less important to your life, you are committing a sacrifice. And Rand says you shouldn't do that.
That's great. Thanks. I think we've used the first half of this conversation to dig into some really important foundational ideas about objectivism and Rand's thinking about the world. We're going to take our break here. We're going to come back and we're going to dig more into our conversation about objectivism with Craig Biddle. The Curious Task is a podcast by the Institute for Liberal Studies. Feel free to send questions and feedback to curioustask@liberalstudies.ca. Special thanks to our supporters on Patreon, including Amy Willis, Chris Rondolo, and Christopher McDonald. Remember to follow us and rate us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Welcome back to The Curious Task. I'm talking today about the question, what is objectivism, with my guest, Craig Biddle. Ayn Rand was a big fan, big believer of the United States. You mentioned in your introduction of her that she really thought of herself as an American. What made the United States special in Rand's mind?
So she held that the United States is the first and only moral nation, or nation founded on a moral idea. Prior to the United States, nations were basically founded on whoever won a war or the like, or whoever had power over others and could maintain it. And the United States was based instead on a principle, a moral principle, the principle of individual rights. And this is in the Declaration of Independence, right? Individuals have a right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And no country prior to the United States had ever done anything like this. So she regarded that as profoundly moral, and we can dig in a little bit and see why. One of the points that Ayn Rand made is that her whole ethics, the whole centerpiece of her philosophy, is basically an undergirding for the Declaration of Independence, or the ideas espoused in the Declaration of Independence. So here the founders say that we have a right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Well, how are we going to undergird that? This is really interesting. The right to life, right? This is the right to act on your judgments so that you can live, right? Well, this ties directly to Ayn Rand's, what she calls the standard of moral value, the standard against which we judge whether something is good or bad, right or wrong. She holds that life is the standard of moral value, literally. So it's the same thing. Life is your fundamental right, and life is, at a deeper moral level, it's the standard of moral value. It's the factual requirements of human life are what constitute what's moral, and those things that act against those factual requirements constitute what's immoral. So there's that. There's this tie to rights, to the right to life. The right to liberty. Well, that's the right to act on your judgment, on your reasoning mind. Rand holds that your reasoning mind is your fundamental life-serving value. She holds reason is man's only absolute. It's the one thing he absolutely must use and be free to use if he is to live. So the right to liberty recognizes that and then says, so no force, because force is the thing that stops that. So here we have a direct link from this right to liberty down through Rand's philosophy. You have to use your mind to act on your judgment in order to live. Why? Because that's the kind of being that you are. She gets right down to metaphysics with this stuff. This is just the fact about human nature that we have to be that way and act that way. So there's the link to her deeper philosophy in regard to liberty. The pursuit of happiness. Now, this is a really profound statement in the Declaration of Independence, that we have a right to the pursuit of happiness. Because what does this mean? I literally get to choose what I want to do with my life. You can't tell me. He can't tell me. The king can't tell me. The government can't. No one can tell me. Only I can do this. This is egoism. This is the very idea that my life belongs to me and the good is for me to choose what I want to do with my life, right? So this right to the pursuit of happiness recognizes several things, at least implicitly, right off the bat. It recognizes, hey, the individual is what matters, not the group, the founders didn't like democracy. The democratic process, voting for your representatives is fine, but not majority rule, right? The idea that the majority gets to tell the individual what he or she is going to do is out. That's not what they were for. So individualism is inherent there. And deeper than individualism is egoism, just this idea. Hey, the fundamental unit of moral and political concern in this new country is the individual. He or she gets to choose what. Now you know, we had, you know, that we had slavery, and you know, and we, you know, it took a while for to come around on several things, women's rights and homosexual rights and all sorts of things. So I'm not saying it was flawless from the beginning, but the idea was there, right? That individuals have rights, and that idea is precisely what liberated blacks and women and gays and everyone over time. So it's the idea, it really was inherent there. So Rand's idea here is that the founders were essentially right about that we have these rights, but she was able to tie these rights philosophically to the factual requirements of human life and to point out why human life is the standard of moral value. That's a separate thing we could talk about. But that's sort of the reason that she regarded the United States as the most moral and really only morally founded country in the history of mankind. And it's also an indication of the connection between her thinking, her deeper thinking, and what the founders used. And the founders were working off basically of the Lockean, John Locke's ideas about the nature of rights and others as well, Montesquieu and others, in terms of separation of powers and all of that. But the grounding for those rights was not fully clear. And by the way, that's why people came along later, the positivists and the utilitarians, and disrupted this whole project by saying rights are nonsense upon stilts. And then progressivism gets born out of that. Yeah, there's no such thing as rights. We're just gonna have to go with what the leaders and the elite tell us, right, and whatnot. So, her, you know, really grasping her connection to what the founders advocated and the deeper ideas that she holds to support that is powerful stuff.
As you mentioned there, you know, the United States is a different country now than it was at the time of its founding. And there's definitely ways in which that is a good thing, abolition of slavery, rights for women, and all those sorts of things. There are also ways in which some people might say it's not as good a country as it was at its founding. So I'm curious, if Rand was able to be with us today, would she still describe the U.S. as a moral society?
I think she would, in essence. I hesitate ever to do anything to, you know, speak for Rand or anyone else who's dead for that matter. I mean, it's just not. But I think based on the pattern of her thinking, she would still today say, not only would she still say that America was moral in its founding principles, she would also recognize that a lot of Americans still want that kind of America, and they still want to uphold that principle. The problem is so few know how to uphold it. I'm very optimistic, and I think Ayn Rand was very optimistic about human beings. She thought that most people, and I certainly do, most people are good. And John Locke thought this too, by the way. John Locke thought, you know, hey, the reason we need government isn't because most people are bad. Most people are good. The reason we need government is because some people will choose to be bad, and even perfectly good people can disagree about things. So we need to have a government. And Rand thought the same thing about government. And when it comes to ethics and people trying to guide their lives, I think she would agree that most people do want to live and go by reason and figure out what's true and all. The problem is philosophy is difficult, and we have been ill-taught philosophically from day one. In ethics alone, we're told, hey, sacrifice is good. Johnny, share your truck, even though you don't want to. You know, it's better to give than to receive, et cetera, et cetera. And because of that, we grow up with just sort of a discombobulated understanding of what supports the kind of life that we want to live. So I think Rand would definitely look at America today and she'd say, yeah, this is one discombobulated country right now. It's gotten better in certain regards. I think she would agree with you on that. And it's gotten worse in others. One of the ways in which it's really gotten worse is a disregard for the possibility of truth. Of objective knowledge, of knowledge of what's, you know, postmodernism was alive and kicking while Rand was doing her work, but it hadn't come to full fruition yet. And it wasn't until, I think, after she died that it really started to blossom and do its destruction in the universities and in the culture. And today we have all sorts of different names for it, wokeism, this, that, and the other. But I regard all of this as postmodernism. It's the idea that there's no such thing as truth or, you know, objective reality out there that we can access. It's all, hey, what do we as a group want to do and how are we going to do it? Richard Rorty's the perfect example of this. He's the fusion of pragmatism, the idea that there are no principles, there's only what works, and groupthink. Hey, what do we want to do? His book was Achieving Our Country, one of his books. And the idea was, what do we want to do? We want to take control of the wealth and redistribute it. That's our goal. So what's going to work to make that happen, right? That's kind of where we are, not just with redistribution of wealth, but with control over the lives of everyone today. That's what the woke activists want. They're against, in my view, I'll say a few harsh things here. I believe they are literally against Western values and ultimately against reason and goodness and human life. Now, I'm not saying all of the kids on campuses who are mouthing the words that their professors have told them or implied to them. I think most of those kids are ignorant and they're going to regret the stuff they're doing now later. But the professors who are advocating moral subjectivism and epistemological skepticism and all of that, especially in light of the fact that thinkers like Rand have put on the table a very clear explanation of why morality is and can be objective and why knowledge is accessible and demonstrable and verifiable and all of that. These professors who are ignoring all of that because they just want to destroy the West, I believe are all evil.
I want to pick up on a thread you mentioned sort of about halfway through that answer about limited government. I've spent about almost 20 years now spending a lot of time with libertarians and classical liberals, people who think about limited government. But in those circles, you also meet anarchists, people who say that limited government is either not desirable or not achievable, and that what we actually want is a free society without government, where people are absolutely free to do as they see fit, and all the institutions and interactions will be voluntary. Now, a lot of people I speak to have some degree of influence by Rand, and some of the anarchists I've spoken to will say something along the lines of, Ayn Rand was a clear thinker who was right about a lot of things, and if she had followed her own thinking to its logical conclusion, then she too would have been an anarchist. Why wasn't Rand an anarchist, and what does objectivism have to say about anarchism?
So Rand really railed against anarchism, and I think for good reason. When we talk about anarchism, you have to be really clear what you mean by it. And one of my favorite thinkers, Auburn Herbert, who was a British parliamentarian and great philosopher, he wrote The Right and Wrong of Compulsion by the State. He actually died right around the time Ayn Rand was born, so they kind of just missed each other. But Herbert was against anarchism as well, and he made the point that anarchists don't really understand their own philosophy because they think that you can have no government. But as soon as you have, quote, no government, what happens? Well, people realize that some people are going to try to steal their stuff and get away with things that you don't want them to get away with. So how are you going to stop that? Are you just going to arm yourself and deal with the gangs as they show up? No. You're going to form some kind of a gang yourself to protect yourself from the other gangs, right? And as soon as you have gangs, you have governments, because whoever can, you know, lord it over the others is going to take control, and then you have a government. So in Herbert's view, there really is no such thing as anarchism. It's just a myth or a temporary situation until a gang of thugs takes over and says, we're going to rule. Rand went beyond that kind of understanding and pointed to the positive value of a rights-protecting government. Now, if you think that there's no way to have a government that actually protects rights, if your view is all government just lords it over people and stops them from acting on their judgment and therefore is anti-life, then you're not going to get this. So one of the things we have to do to understand why government can be good is look at history. prior to the founding of the United States of America, all governments had been basically just dictatorships of some sort, right? Kings or whatever. And they the idea of rights as a founding principle didn't exist. Now the founders come along and they introduce this idea of a right as a founding principle. They codify it in a constitution and say, this is the fundamental law of the land. And lo and behold, things got much better. Took a while to get rid of slavery and the other elements that we already talked about, but things did get better. Now, we can't deny that things can get better when a new good idea comes along, because we can see that it has happened, right? So, and a lot of anarchists like to say, well, all government is bad and always will be bad. And I like to point out, well, look, some governments were much better than others and that betterness made a big difference. Can't we see and agree on that? As soon as you have that agreement, and there's no grounds not to have that agreement because you can just see it in history, then we can say, well, look, if we have an even better idea based on the solidified idea of rights grounded in reality, which is government's only proper purpose is to protect rights by banning force and using force only in retaliation and only against those who initiate its use. And if we codify that in a constitution and in the laws of the land, and then we do due diligence, right? We have to be eternally vigilant, as the founders would say. You can't just write a constitution and then abandon it, right? Eternal vigilance is necessary. But if we do that, you can have a society run by a legal system that keeps its hands off of people completely and only uses force against those who initiate its use. Now, the immediate question comes up, how are you going to fund this thing if you don't use force? Because everybody thinks governments have to be funded through taxation. And I wrote an article titled, How Would Government Be Funded in a Free Society, to address this very question. So I recommend that to your listeners if they want to look that up. But the short of it is that you don't need, I have to preface this with, you're not going to have a laissez-faire government and a fully rights-protecting government until the culture is ready for that, right? I can't fly into North Korea today and just go, hey, let's just set up a government that lets everybody act on their own judgment, right? And you can't even do that in the United States today because people aren't ready for it. So we have to work toward a culture that says, oh yeah, force used against human beings is immoral and properly illegal. And so, and not everyone has to agree on this, but enough people have to agree on it that it shifts the tide of the culture, as the founders shifted the tide of their culture by pointing out their new idea. If you get there, then you can have a system that is supported voluntarily. You just have the government's, the branch of the government that deals with the budget comes out every year or three with a budget. And they say, here's what we need to have the courts, the police, and the military, and all of the aspects of those branches of government that are necessary to protect rights. The expense to run that kind of government would be a fraction of what it is today with all the ABC agencies and all the handouts and everything. It would probably be under 5% of what it is today. So then you tell the populace, this is what we need to run the government. So, send your support checks to do that here. Now, why would McDonald's or Amazon send support to a government that only protects rights? Well, think about the marketplace value of having done so and the marketplace disvalue of not having done so. If Burger King finds out that McDonald's refuses to support a rights-protecting government, how well is that going to play for Burger King in their next advertisement about the difference between the two burger chains, right? And I get into this kind of stuff in the article, but the point is this. People and organizations who are sane and rational want to support a freedom protecting, rights protecting government, because we need that in order to live. So for the same reason that people buy insurance and take their kids to the dentist, et cetera, they would support this overarching requirement of all of those values. If you don't have freedom, you can't keep your home, you can't keep your kids, you can't keep your wife safe, you can't do like. So there's no reason in the world to think that people who can support a rights protecting government if they choose to wouldn't do so if the government otherwise got out of their way. And the last point I'll make on this is, if you do have a truly free society, people get insanely wealthy. I mean, just crazy. Look at America today, where you know, people, 40% of people's income is taken, and there's all sorts of regulations in this, that, and the other. And our wealth level is still quite high. You take all of that, that illegitimate aspect of government out of the picture, and people would become crazy wealthy. They would want to keep that wealth. Who has the most to lose? A guy with, you know, four yachts and five mansions, or the guy with nothing, right? I mean, it's just obvious point. So in my view, if we get the culture to where people are on in agreement that we need to have a government that bans force, and that obviously makes sense so we can all thrive, the vast majority of people are going to want to contribute to that. And the few who don't, the free riders, first of all, if you're in school at the time and you're not making any money, you have no business giving money to the government because you don't have any money. That would be a sacrifice. So there are different kinds of free riders. There's free riders of necessity given their place in life right now. And there's free riders of the variety, well, I'll let you suckers pay for it. I'm not going to pay for it. And those kind, that second kind of free rider, they would not do well in a rational culture and a free society. Who would invite them to parties? Who would even be friends with them? Who would do business with them if they knew that they were, that that was their attitude? Nobody would. Nobody except other crooks and criminals and worthless people. So I don't think there's any problem in supporting a free society and a rights-protecting government once we get there. And the last thing I'll say about Rand's idea about why we need government is simply that it's just not true that we can function unless there's an objective source to go to when we have disagreements about things. It's not only about criminals. You and I could go into business together, and our initial agreement could be a thing that you think means one thing and I think means another. And 5 years down the line, we might realize, we had a difference of opinion on what that agreement meant. And instead of you and me duking it out, we can go to court. We can go to the government and say, hey, here's what we thought. Here's the documentation. And we can't come to an agreement on this. So we need help with that. And that's what the courts can do and the government can do. And of course, we need governments for, you know, foreign policy. You have people who want to come over here and kill us all, or look at Israel. You know, people want to go kill all the Jews. What are you going to do if you don't have a government to protect you from thugs? So I think the whole business of anarchism, although I can understand if people looked at government today and they're like, okay, the Democrats want to steal your stuff this way and the Republicans want to steal your stuff that way. And if you thought the only third alternative was to get rid of the government, right, if literally that's where your mind is, I'd be sympathetic to that too. But it's not the only alternative. You can have a government that protects rights. We know it because we've seen governments do much better than other governments on the basis of the idea of protecting rights. We just need to get more people to agree with that and go all the way.
Great. This is going exactly where I was hoping it would. So you've described a philosophy that has a firm belief in individual rights, individual autonomy, the freedom of the individual to make choices and to choose the way they want to live their own life. However, we do need a government to put some rules to prevent theft and murder and these sorts of things, to have someone to go to arbitrate disagreements. It sounds a lot like classical liberalism or libertarianism, and yet, of course, objectivism is not those philosophies. So what are the differences between a classical liberal worldview and an objectivist philosophy?
I think that objectivism does fall under the umbrella of classical liberalism. I mean, Ayn Rand never spoke about this personally, to my knowledge, so I don't know whether she would place it that way. But I think it does, because I think classical liberalism has a few key features. First of all, it holds the individual as the basic unit of moral and political concern. Individualism is really the core, I think, of liberalism. It holds reason and knowledge based on sensory evidence as really the grounding for the better people who are the better people in the Enlightenment and the better people that I would classify as classical liberals. For instance, John Locke, held this imperfectly. Locke was also religious and held faith to, in some regard. But he also said in a very Aristotelian mood that that knowledge comes from sensory perception or reasoning based on sensory perception. And I think that's absolutely true. And this is definitely a core principle of objectivism. So you've got reason, the individual, the pursuit of happiness, which is essentially egoism codified in law. It's like, yes, you get to do you and I'll do me. And then if we want to work together, we can. And if we don't, we don't have to, right? So, and then that's the principle of rights. They're based on the principle of egoism. And I think all of this, these principles that are both in the classical liberal tradition and in the objectivist tradition really come together. So I see objectivism as essentially the blossoming into full grounded fruition of classical liberalism. Libertarianism, I think, is a really mixed idea, and Rand didn't like it in the time that she was writing and thinking about it. It's when libertarian movement was starting, and some of the people in it, Rothbard and others, were using her ideas without giving credit, and they were advocating anarchism, which she really recognized as a problem. So she repudiated libertarianism as such. Today, I think a lot of people who call themselves libertarians are not anarchists, and they're not, you know, against, you know, reason and intellectual property rights and this, that, and the other. So I don't think that it's fair to just brand libertarians and libertarianism as bad per se. I wrote an article titled Radical Capitalism or Libertarianism versus Radical Capitalism, where I get to some of the distinctions between the objectivist view and what libertarianism is. And in that article, I make the point that unfortunately, libertarianism, I think properly defined, is the idea that we can defend political liberty while ignoring or denying the fundamental philosophic and moral foundations for political liberty. And it's just not true that we can do that. And if that, and the way that I look at it, I take a historic view in there talking about the various people in the libertarian movement who argue for this very idea that we can defend liberty without going to the philosophic fundamentals. And so I really think that's what libertarianism amounts to. And when I meet libertarians, I try to convince them to look into Rand's ideas and see the relationships between ideas, good ideas that they have and want to uphold, and the fact that you can't uphold those if you don't have a grounding for it. Definitely, I think in my view, objectivism is an aspect of classical liberalism. Libertarianism is kind of a package deal. It puts together a bunch of people who might not necessarily have the same fundamental view. So I try not to use the term. And when I'm talking about politics, I try to be descriptive instead of just label things. If I'm going to say I'm for capitalism, I have to follow that up with, by which I mean a social system where the government does one thing, it protects rights by banning force, so you and me and everyone else, we can act on our judgment and live beautiful lives, right? I try to paint a picture of what we're after rather than just say no aggression principle, right? Which doesn't really get us anywhere.
That's great. Thanks. And I may have set a bit of a trap for you there by using classical liberal and libertarian interchangeably, as I often do. I have many friends who think we should draw strong distinctions. However, those friends do not agree on what those distinctions should be, which is part of the reason I think they do get used interchangeably. Craig, we've had a great conversation. The time has flown by and we are almost out of our time. In conclusion, I want to give you the chance to give a couple of reading recommendations. So I'm going to ask you first to recommend what someone who's listened to our podcast, enjoyed this conversation, has never read any Rand, what is it that that person should go to Amazon or their local bookstore and pick up?
Oh, goodness, there's so much. I mean, I think reading Rand's fiction, especially for your listeners who are interested in liberty and classical liberalism and the like, reading Atlas Shrugged is the best place to start because it gives life to the ideas right on the page, right? It gives examples of what these ideas mean in practice and what the bad ideas mean in practice. And it does so incidentally in a way, if you read Atlas Shrugged today every third page, you're going to be going, oh my God, this is happening today. And it's just wild how seemingly prophetic the book is. And that book both is a beautiful story about, and really powerful mystery story about the importance of reason and what happens when the men of the mind, as Ayn Rand describes them, disappear from the world. And so it's a sort of a cautionary tale, but it's also a very positive statement about her philosophy because she gets into the positive elements of it in the book as well. So I would start there. Her nonfiction that would be of interest to people particularly interested in liberty include Capitalism, The Unknown Ideal, where she really points out, by the way, in the first essay in that book is where she gets into that trichotomy I brought up earlier, the subjective versus the intrinsic versus the objective. And that's so people want to read up on that. It's in the first essay in there titled What is Capitalism? The Virtue of Selfishness is her book on ethics. That's a really rich book. And there are some other books that might be helpful to as an introduction to her ideas. My book, Loving Life, The Morality of Self-Interest and the Facts That Support It, is a really accessible book about the objectivist ethics. And it's also a chapter book where each chapter builds on the earlier ones. So you get a full argument over 150 pages or whatever. And then for the things we've talked about today, you can also go to my journal, The Objective Standard, and search either libertarianism or capitalism or classical liberalism, any of those kinds of terms, you're going to find a bunch of articles written over our 19 years of publishing on these topics from an objectivist perspective. And I take pride in the fact that the articles at the Objective Standard are crystal clear and beautifully structured, almost to an article throughout all of our publication years. So I think your readers would enjoy that.
That's great. Thanks. We will link to many of the things that we've talked about and mentioned, books and essays and articles, in the show notes. Greg Biddle, it's been a pleasure to have you on The Curious Task. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you, Matt. Been a pleasure.
The Curious Task is a podcast from the Institute for Liberal Studies. This episode was produced by Sabine Alchidiak and Eric Sege. The music you hear on the podcast is by Lindy Valpenfjord. You should check out his music online. The Curious Task exists today because of donations of time and money from those creating it, and listeners like yourself. I'm Matt Buffton. Thanks again for joining us on The Curious Task.